Then I would start. Thanks a lot, Audrey, for the invitation and for the honor to have the conversation tonight with our guest Mohamed Abdouni. Before I introduce you, I say perhaps first one or two sentences about me, but also in the general introduction, I'll also add one or two sentences how we got to know each other. So my name is Julian Volz. At the moment, I work as a research associate and a PhD student in the University of Lüneburg at Leuphana University, where I'm writing a PhD on decolonization in Algeria and contemporary arts. And I'm also sometimes curating things and writing about exhibitions. So that's about me. And so now to our guest. I'm very happy to welcome everyone tonight to our artist talk with Mohamed Abdouni. And Mohamed, you're working as a photographer as well as an artistic art photographer and as a fashion photographer. You're a filmmaker, a curator, and the editor of Cold Cuts magazine, a magazine on queer culture from the Southwest Asian and North African region. We have two issues of the magazine here somewhere in the space, and we'll also talk later a bit about this magazine and how it came into being. So important solo exhibitions of yours took place at MENA Image Center, Lebanon, where you presented your project Treat Me Like Your Mother on trans histories from Beirut, where we'll also talk about later, and other solo exhibitions of Mohamed were at Lior Biennial, at Art Basel Paris, and furthermore, you participated in group shows in places such as Suzak Museum, Beirut, Guts Gallery London, Contact Photography Festival in Canada, or the Institut du Monde Arabe in Paris, and your films, especially the one on Anya Nies that is on show at the space here, has been shown on festivals in North America, in Europe, as well as in the Southwest Asian and North African region. So I'm especially delighted that we'll have this conversation tonight about your film Anya Nies and on queer culture in Lebanon, as we already had a similar discussion 5 years ago, and I'm really curious what has happened in the meantime and what has changed. Personally, in 2019, I was working on a curatorial project on queer art from the Arab-speaking region, and my starting point back then for my project was a bit a lack that I saw, or frustration that stories that we get to know here in Germany and in Europe about queers from the Arab-speaking region were mainly stories about sadness, about depression, or of hiding in the closet. And I would say these are also these representations of queerness and homosexuality in the Arab world, they are also inscribed like in Orientalist representations of Arabs and their sexuality. And so I was very happy to discover your artistic work, Mohamed, which includes the magazine Cold Cuts and the documentary Anya Nies, which already existed back then in 2019. And this work really impressed me then because your photographs and films you can find on the contrary, not these stories of only sadness, but it was, I discovered a lust for life and an Arab queer self-confidence that is very joyful. And I think everyone who has seen the film will notice this. And so I decided to travel to Beirut in the April of 2019. And you were so kind and invited me to your home in the outskirts of Beirut, where you were living back then with your partner. A lot of things have happened in Lebanon and in the world since our last conversation. Just to name the social mass protest, the revolt in Lebanon against the inflation and the corrupt government. Then in 2020, the explosion in the port of Beirut, which had a major influence on the country. And as everyone knows, the new war that Israel is leading at the moment against the country and against the Gaza Strip. And, but also on a personal level, there were quite some changes, such as a growing visibility and recognition of your work in the last 5 years. And also the move of your main residency from Beirut to Istanbul, as you told me now during our conversation this evening, you're now about to leave Istanbul again, and now you're more living between Beirut and Paris at the moment. And so now I'm really looking forward to take up our conversation, and I'm curious what you have to tell us. So perhaps let's start with your background and how this all started. You trained as a photographer, and I think it was in 2017 that you made as well the documentary, and you also started with the magazine Cold Cut. So could you tell us perhaps a bit how you got there? What was the starting moment and the starting point of all these projects?
So first of all, thank you all for coming. I always find it fascinating whenever a group of people decide that they want to hear an artist talk. I personally find that we talk terribly, but which is why I think we do what we do, because we're not good with our words, but I will try my best. I will also change the way I am sitting, just because I am currently struggling with a bit of a migraine, so I will be sitting this way so I can lean on this. But thank you for coming. So the journey that led basically to what I do is the question. It is a very long and tumultuous journey, but like to simplify it, I did study arts, but I studied painting.
Not just because I was giving the wrong information.
Yeah, so I didn't study photography actually, and I didn't study filmmaking. I studied painting, and I very quickly was bored with painting because it was such a long process, and I needed things to be very immediate, because I'm a very patient person. And I think that's when I bought my first camera, my first 35mm camera during my first year in college. And it was just for like one elective course that I did terribly at. And I had to redo the class actually, because I failed miserably. But I fell in love with photography. And since I just kept, I never took up another class because I realized that I didn't seem to be doing very well at it. But I continued doing so just because I have a very forgetful nature, so I forget a lot. And that was my way of keeping track of very little moments and very little things, because I think with our phones, we, I don't know, like, does anyone really go through their old pictures on their phones? Yeah. Do you? I don't. I take so many pictures that I'm like, they're lost. So like, when it came to 35mm, it was very concise, you know? I would take pictures of moments that mattered, or people that mattered, or trips that mattered. So it was very selective. It was like I was curating the moments that I wanted to remember. And memory is something that we have a bit of a problem with in the family. We suffer from these issues. So it was always something I was always afraid of. And so not documenting, but keeping track of my own personal things had always been a thing. And how that led to me working in photography. So basically photography for me was just keeping track of my memory. And then the fact that I ended up doing what I do is just fantastically beautiful accident from that thing that I did to myself, and it just sort of happened in a way. And then I started wanting to maybe keep track not just of memories of my own or myself, but memories of I find a weird I have a weird relationship with the word community, but to keep track of memories from people that I feel have really influenced the way we live, and especially in Beirut, the way we live, like whatever little freedoms I might have as a gay man, for example, in Beirut, I know that these freedoms come from people whose stories have not really been recorded. And so that curiosity kind of developed in that sense, where I started wanting to keep track of a collective memory. And yeah, that was a very long answer. I could have said it in 2 sentences.
No, it was very interesting. And so, and then at a certain moment, you shoot the film with Anya Nies. And but perhaps just to grasp a little bit, where was the queer community in Beirut at the time, and how did you get Anya Nies? I mean, yeah, she was also coming to Beirut from the US in 2012, I think. So, what was a bit this moment for queer culture? So, in between 2012 and 2017,
how? So there's a parallel. So first of all, Anya is originally Lebanese, but she was born and raised in California, but she was born and raised more Lebanese, I think, than anyone who was born and raised in Lebanon, because her parents were very Lebanese. So they made sure that she did not grow up American in California. And then Anya moved to Lebanon maybe 5 years or 6 years before we made this documentary. Yeah, I think around that time. At the same time, in parallel, there was during the Civil War and a bit, yeah, during the Civil War and before the Civil War, there was this huge performance movement that was mainly led by trans women at the time. And that almost, not almost, that disappeared, unfortunately, after the Civil War, because of many reasons that we can maybe discuss later. But it was mainly because these trans women who had these safe spaces that existed in the country no longer had these safe spaces. And that was because of cis gay men who no longer allowed these women to enter these spaces, to be part of these clubs or part of these bars. And so... So there was no more queer performances or a queer performance scene in Lebanon anymore, unfortunately. Like not even like the underground of the underground of the underground. Like it just did not exist. And so when Anya moved back to Beirut, she was kind of like not understanding like where anything, give me an apartment where I can just, you know, perform. And I think, and that's Anya's influence really on the queer culture in Lebanon, which is obviously she did not invent drag culture, but she was able to revive this art form and create a community. And that's why so many people owe so much to Anya. So many people in Lebanon owe so much to Anya, because she kind of like reinstated some of these spaces and was able to convince some of these spaces to reopen these opportunities for people. And unfortunately, Anya happens to be my best friend. So when it comes to this documentary, it wasn't really anything planned at all. We shot the footage on a random weekend right before a performance where she makes her own costumes, she makes everything, and she just does everything. She's like a one-woman show. And on one of those weekends, I had just thought, since I always hang out with her anyway while she's preparing, to just, you know, always accompany her while she's doing her thing, I'll just have my little camera and I'll just shoot some random scenes. And we did that without any like end game in mind. Like no one was making a documentary or a film or anything. Although in her head, she's the protagonist of life and she should be like the actress of every film. But I was not ready to make her dreams come true at the time. And then I think almost a year later, and so yeah, so the footage was there and we just put it in. Great, we shot some stuff. And then almost a year later, she was going through a very rough time. And I think we were all going through a bit of a rough time. And we were having a lot of conversations that were, even though we had been such close friends for so long, we hadn't really tackled any of these conversations. It's mainly things that just go by without really ever being talked about, which is kind of like a common thing in Lebanon, you know? You just don't address things. Because if you address them, then you have to have an opinion on them and you have to do something about it. And we know that there's so little sometimes we can do about it. But we were finally having these conversations, and so that was like almost a year later. And then at some point, we decided maybe we should record some of these conversations, again, for no reason other than to just record them. And I think very shortly after we recorded one of these conversations, we thought of just cutting this film together, of bringing back that footage and kind of just piecing something together, because during that time, it was very different and she was very different and we were all very different. It was a more joyful year when we were shooting. And then when we were having these conversations, it was like a different time. And it felt like it had nothing to do with queerness. These conversations, like we were all feeling the same way she was feeling. We were all feeling these burdens of family, but at the same time, it's family. It's not really a burden, it's more of a like a duty, but things were getting more and more difficult, etc. And then that's how we ended up making the film. We just put it together very quickly with the help of a few friends that, you know, like worked on sound and colored the film and edited the film, etc. Film, like we never called it film at the time. It was like a little video. And then we just put it on YouTube. That's it. That was the whole point. And it still baffles me today that this film gets shown in places and festivals and in things, because like, it's just a little video that we put together. And I was telling Audrey this because, and I was telling actually some of the students yesterday, I think I learned so much more about this film than I can actually say from people's reactions to the film. Like people come and go like, oh, like, for example, this, or I felt this about them. And I'm like, whoa, good, nice, okay, great. And then I've learned to love this little film with time.
No, I think it's also so well received because, as I mentioned it before, there is so few information in Western countries about queer culture in other parts of the world, and people get so less information and about drag culture in Beirut. I think no one knows before, and so I think it's really stunning to, and also especially because it's such a, you, I mean, you feel the intimacy. It's a very direct shooting and a friendship, and I think that's really nice. And what I found now very interesting, what I wasn't aware before, is that the sound was recorded later, but because this is also something that I noticed that on the audio level, it's more severe, or it's more about homophobia, while the pictures, they show a big joy and a big freedom, I think that also makes the film very joyful, that you see how it's liberating.
But you know, also, I don't think I maybe at some point I did think this. I think I always look at this film much more as like a little expression about friendship, much more than I find it to be about queerness or drag culture or yeah. Yeah.
And so would you say this track also was for her had a very important function to flee about this homophobia she encountered in her family? Or?
I mean, questions for her to answer. Yes. But what
how did
I
you
will perceive? Say, yeah. What I will say from her mouth is that finally being able to continue doing drag in Beirut was the only thing that kind of allowed her to survive in Beirut for almost 10 years, you know, or else I don't think she would have been able to survive without that little kind of expression of freedom.
So what also would interest me about this film, we already talked also a bit about, is the reception of it. It was shown as well in the West, in Western countries, as in Arab countries such as Tunisia and Palestine on queer film festivals. So did you perceive a different reception of the film, or how was the different feedbacks you got?
So I obviously wasn't able to go to all of these things, especially not to Palestine, unfortunately, but nor Tunisia for that fact, actually. But the reception has been fun, I think, to say the least, especially by a non-queer audience. And I feel like I'm repeating the same things I said yesterday, but I think one of the funnest comments I got was from like this like straight man in his 30s that was very, let's say, did not have a lot of gay friends. Let's just say that. And right after a Q&A, I think that was in Amsterdam, he spots me outside and he goes like, "Bro, this guy is just like me. I just don't dress up like girls, you know?" And I'm like, "Yeah, great. Fantastic. If that's what you get out of it, I'm happy."
And in Beirut, did you show it to friends or to the community? How was it there?
We did do a screening in Beirut. But the thing is, the screenings are they're like an extra novelty, because the book, much like everything else I do, is always available online. So it's just, the film existed online before anything, and we never removed it. So which makes it even weirder that it still gets shown in festivals. But so most of the reception was reception that I would receive, either comments on YouTube or emails or things like that. But yeah, generally positive.
Cool. Perhaps then let's move on to other parts of your work, perhaps also with Cold Cuts magazine that I already mentioned. So the first and the second issue has a bit of a different approach than the special issues you did. So perhaps let's talk first about the first issue, where you brought together a broad range of photography of queer photographers from the region. And how did this come into existence? Was it all friends and peers whose work you admired, or what was the idea behind?
So I had already been in publishing much before Cold Cuts, and then I kind of left the periodic publishing world, and then I worked in construction for 8 years.
Construction.
In construction, Julian. behind a desk. I had a computer and everything, like a desktop computer and everything. And it was a PC, it wasn't even a Mac. And I had missed it. I had just missed publishing, because I don't think I love anything more than just paper and books. Well, maybe music, but then paper and books. And so I really wanted to get into publishing again, but I knew that I wanted to get into publishing in a completely different way than how I was publishing before. So basically, I had such a love for publishing, but I also hated so much that came with independent publishing, because publishing independently is just, it's exhausting and it's time consuming and it's so costly. And so I realized that I was spending most of my time getting sponsors and making sure I have enough money to print and getting advertisers, etc. And I was spending much less time actually creating the issues and having fun and putting them together. And that's when I stopped the magazine at the time, which was called FIMP, F-I-M-P. And it was an arts and culture magazine also in the region, in the Arab region. So I wanted to do it differently. And by that, I meant I did not want to make money out of it. I wanted no sponsors, no advertisers, no nothing. I wanted it to be aperiodical. I did not want to stress out about when it comes out, how it comes out, where it's distributed. I didn't want to have to deal with any distribution companies, any cuts, any shipping, anything. I didn't want to deal with anything. I just wanted to have fun. That's all I wanted to do. So that's when Anya and I sat down. We were like, okay, so let's just do that, basically. Whenever we have enough money from our commercial projects to put out an issue, we just put out an issue. And we worked on the first, and we also wanted to have no rules for cold cuts. So cold cuts doesn't, I mean, even the most basic of guides or guidelines, like a reason for it to exist or a tagline for it. Like, for example, you called it a queer photo journal, whereas it's a photo journal. It is currently exploring queer cultures, but that might change according to my affinity next week. But even a logo, for example, Cold Cuts doesn't have one. So everything would change. The design of it would change. What is inside of it changes.
Also the format.
The format changes.
The second issue is completely different at first.
Because, I mean, the whole point of working on a publication, again, was just to have fun. And I do not necessarily enjoy just being restricted to certain formats that I will be bored of in a week. So we started just actually, we wanted the first issue to be a bit of a salad of just different artists that I've either worked with in the past or just admired or just were part of, you know, a greater network. And we put together that issue without necessarily having in mind that we were putting together a queer photo journal, let's say. But very quickly, and Anya reminded me constantly that we were putting together a queer publication. And so I caved at the end and I was like, fine, we're putting together a queer issue. And we did. And so was the second one. And then the first, and so then the third one and the fourth one. And actually all the issues are queer issues. But I still need to give myself the freedom of, you know, it might not be next time. So far we have two issues that we call issue one and issue two, which are basically just different artists, photographers, writers, illustrators, etc., that more or less usually have carte blanche to just discuss whatever they want. And we have our special edition issues, which are basically just me being very pompous and basically taking over the whole thing and it being all about my work. And that's the two special editions, Doris and Andrea, which basically is like a 172-page photo book issue publication that chronicles the lives of one mother and her gender queer son daughter Andrea over like 172 photos. And the latest issue, which is Treat Me Like Your Mother, which is an archival issue of trans feminine experiences in post-war Beirut.
Let's perhaps come first back to the first, to Doris and Andrea. You also showed some of the photographs you made at the Institut de Culture d'Islam, also in Paris, in a group show, which was also very nice because it was a general show about Lebanon, where you brought in this, this queer aspect. And Andrea was also an assistant of yours, right?
Yes.
Could you tell us a bit more about the background of Andrea and how this project and also the exhibition in Paris came into being?
So first of all, the series Doris and Andrea, and so eventually the issue and the exhibition, everything was actually commissioned by the curator Sabine Roussoub, who was curating the show at Institut de Culture d'Islam, which was amazing because it was the first time that an Islamic institute commissions or even creates space to showcase a queer narrative, which I think was awesome.
Yes.
Andrea, so maybe a couple of years, maybe like a year or two after Anya kind of like revived this little drag scene in Lebanon, you know, a lot of like new queens started coming out, etc., and started performing. And I would document, I would go at night and I would take pictures and you know, just support and enjoy and document. And I would always send the pictures to the queens, right, on Instagram. Because, I mean, obviously, who doesn't want pictures of themselves performing? And so I didn't really know Andrea, or like, not on a personal level. And then I remember she thanked me for the pictures on Instagram. She said, like, thank you. And then the next thing you know, she posts like a carousel of the pictures and they're like edited to death. Like the colors are changed and like some are black and white and like I'm not even like mentioned. And I'm like, I text her right away. I'm like, and she was like 16 or 17, I think. And I'm like, I'm gonna teach you a couple of things. We're gonna have coffee. And I talked to her about how you don't touch a photographer's photos and how you always credit things about life. And then I hired her as my assistant. And so that so that she can learn the ropes firsthand. And yeah, and we built like this friendship and this relationship, and very quickly I got to learn about her mother, who is one of the most amazing mothers I've met. She, like, it's incredibly ridiculous how supportive she is and of everything that Andrea does, and I fell in love with their relationship, and because whenever we discuss families in an Arab context, it's always very like political correctness, Muhammad, political correctness, okay. You know, like there are certain, like, we talk about morals and rules and things, but that's only one aspect of things. And it was very important for me to kind of showcase that when it comes to family in an Arab context, what rules before anything else is love. And so that was basically what Doris and Andrea was. It was just showing love.
Nice. And are you still collaborating with Andrea? Hmm? Are you still collaborating with Andrea, or how's
she I think it's enough collaborating with Andrea. I think she's had enough of collaborating with Andrea. She has been on every cover of every magazine possible. Like Anya's jealous. Anya's like, I am the OG. Yeah.
But what's she doing now?
She's in Beirut. She has grown her makeup business, and now she is doing fantastically well. She does makeup for TV series, and she has grown far from being my assistant. I'm very proud of her.
Amazing. And yeah, and so the second special issue was more a turn to the archival and to the older forgotten histories during the Civil War and in the first years after the Civil War that you already mentioned before. And yeah, this was a bit the turn from your practice as being a photographer to be an artistic researcher, an artist working with archives. So how did this turn come? Or yeah,
So Anya calls me at 3 a.m. on a Tuesday crying. Because she went to some, like an open mic night thing that was held in Beirut, where an older trans woman came up on stage and started telling stories. Stories about her youth. And Anya was just crying because she's like, how do I not know these stories? How do I not know that we had balls before Harlem had balls? How do I not know all of these things? And it was right then and there on a Tuesday at 3 a.m. where I'm like, okay, let's do this. Let's dedicate the next issue to that. Let's collect as many histories as we can. Let's do our best to have a beginning of an archive, which is what Treat Me Like Your Mother is. It is a very humble beginning of an archive of trans feminine experiences.
And it's already a very amazing archive.
But if you think about it, it's a really small archive. Mm. Because, I mean, in 4 or 5 years, we were not able to collect more than 300 color positives. Like, if you think about it, that's a small archive. Yeah. But also what was important was to record their oral histories.
Yes, and I mean, this I also would say is part of the archive.
Yeah, yeah,
not definitely. Only the photographic.
Definitely. But and in that sense,
this one you created, no? With,
yeah. In that sense, yes. Yeah. And it was important to kind of like, because none of these women's stories and histories have ever really been recorded. And whenever these women would be interviewed, it was always within the not constructs or shackles, but within like the framework of either NGO work or foreign journalist work, which basically just focused on their traumas and in that sense perpetuated more trauma in these women. So there was a lot of hesitation from these women, and that's why it was very important that we work with Hilm, who is an NGO, but you need to work within what you can work in. to be able to kind of like start these conversations with these women who very quickly kind of realized that we're not looking for trauma. We're just like, just tell us your stories the way you see your stories. And what was fascinating was Treatment Like Your Mother has 10 women. And it was important to record because there's no actual recording of the, like, when these women leave us, their stories leave with them. And that's insane. That's history just disappearing into thin air. And sadly, one of the women from Treat Me Like Your Mother passed very quickly after the book was released. And the stories that that she was so generous enough to share with us are stories where I cannot imagine a world where they are not recorded. So can you imagine every other woman and every other story that are no longer with us? And that, anyway, I am digressing. But yeah, so how they chose, how each, what was fascinating was to see how each woman sees her life, or sees how they would tell their life story. So, because and in the book at the beginning, there's a clear roadmap of the questions that we asked, and they were very broad questions, and they were very little questions. So it was never anything ever specific about anything. It was, and the first question was, how would you like to start by telling us your life story? And the remaining four or five questions are almost in that same vein, kind of like just helpers of. Like, I don't want to use the word guide, because they really didn't guide. They would help
to spark the conversation.
Yes, a little more. But they were very broad and generic. And what was fascinating was exactly that. So, for example, one of the women, like Antonella, for example, Antonella basically sees her entire life story as pre-surgery, surgery, post-surgery. Whereas, let's say Katya, for example, sees her entire life story per boyfriend. That's how she would tell her story. Like, there was this guy, and then there was this guy, and then there was this guy. Like, it was just so beautiful to see how,
yes,
how really each woman would see the pillars of her life, and how she would,
And you already mentioned for the interviews, you developed a very precise protocol that you're also
which was developed by Joy Stacey, who was the co-editor on the book as well.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
And this was not, this was not developed together with Chelem, or? What was the role of Chelem?
So Chelem oversaw everything, basically. Important for us to have Chelem there to make sure that, first of all, for us to get the proper training before going into this, because again, these women have been subjected to so much, and when it comes to any instances where they are sitting next to someone asking them questions, they have only known one way of that, or one. So it was important to work with Chelem to oversee everything, to make sure that everything we were doing was being done ethically, kindly. Not that we really needed, because everything was being done kindly anyway, and we knew our intentions towards the project, but intentions are something, but then the way you handle something is something else. And I am very well aware of where, what I know and what I don't know, what I feel I'm comfortable and confident in and what I don't. And the NGO world is the furthest world from me. So it was important to have Chelem oversee everything.
And for this project, the second, there was also a second collaboration partner, which was the Arab Image Foundation. I don't know if everyone is aware about Arab Image Foundation. It's today, I think it's the biggest photographic archive from the Arab region. It was one of the founders was Akram Satari, one of the most renowned and well-known artists from Lebanon. And from the 90s on, they were really collecting photographs in the whole world, in the whole Arab world, in the whole region, and then, establishing this archive and then also developing artistic perspectives on it. And I think on the one hand, in the magazine, there are historic photographies who come to frame a bit the spirit of the time or the time frame, especially the times of the Civil War. So for me, it also gives a very good idea in which context these drag practices were or trans practices were developed, which I found very interesting. And and then the other part was that the photographs also went into the collection.
Right? Yes, so we donated the entire archive to the Arab Image Foundation, which is, and now it's an open archive to the public, and it's a growing archive. So it's not a monopolized archive. So it's available for researchers, artists, the average Joe to dig into it and get to know more. But it's also there for it to grow, for people to start feeding it and nurturing it, so that we start to. Yeah, so that we archive our stories and our histories, basically.
And how did the collaboration with the Arab Image Foundation started? So was it really the wish to have like a proper institution where you know that these archives are safe and secured, or?
I mean, they weren't gonna do very well in my living room.
Yeah.
I had to put them somewhere. And the Arab Image Foundation is an institution that I really respect, and the work that they do is really fantastic, and their preservation facilities are really fantastic. And and just from an initial conversation with them, they were just so open and keen on having this be an open access archive, and we just aligned so much on our ethics when it comes to this, on how we see this, etc. It was just a very natural. It was a very natural progression of things.
Yeah, probably a very good space to have this.
Yes.
Perhaps if you also could elaborate a bit more on the context of the Civil War, because one would not imagine that a time where there's so much violence on the street, it's also a time where queer culture can develop and flourish.
I am no politician, but no historian, sorry. But that has always and is still to this day the case in Lebanon, and it's very peculiar, and I have no justification for it or an answer for it, but it has always been in dire times that nightlife boomed ever since I can remember, from all the stories that we hear to my actual personal 35, 36 years in Lebanon, whenever things are just terribly bad, nightlife is fantastic. It is the best time. And it's always been like this. It really has always been like this. So, we were surprised by a lot of things during our interviews with the women. That we were not surprised. That did not surprise us. But like things that we found so just fascinating was the fact that these women who today are so constricted to their own homes, who don't really go out anymore, who just prefer to stay in, they find it unsafe outside, felt so incredibly free back in the day, so incredibly free during the Civil War and right after and right before. And politicians would date them openly and with pride. And when we'd hear these stories, they just tug at our hearts so beautifully. They mentioned that the politicians, they mentioned journalists, and they just had this. And the thing is, which I think is kind of like, for me, the main takeaway, which I wasn't aware was going to be the main takeaway from this project, but the main takeaway is the fact that these women, and I'm not talking about these 10 women, but these 10 women were kind of our initiation to all of this. But these trans women were so much a part of the cultural, but also the political history of the country. And their presence has been erased. So their influence on the political course of what has happened over the past, let's say, 50 years in Lebanon is not something we learn, is not something we know about, but their influence was very palpable. And when you hear their stories, or when you read the stories in your case, it makes sense. it just makes so much sense, because you can link, even without them linking things, you automatically link histories you learned at school that you know, and that where you felt there were gaps or loopholes that made no sense, and then they come and they fill them for you, and you're like, whoa. And I think that was the most beautiful takeaway out of, but also sad because yeah. why isn't this taught? But yeah.
And just a hint for everyone: this issue with the collected trans histories from Beirut's past day is free downloadable as a PDF. And when I was preparing for the talk on Sunday I just couldn't stop reading. It's really so fascinating, and it's really yeah. Sorry?
Where can we find that?
On the homepage of Cold Cuts. Of
coldcutsonline.com.
It's really fascinating. Yeah. It's amazing stories. And perhaps the last project before you open to the public, the last project we could talk about is, which also came out of this trans history artistic research and archival project, is a project. We have two works here hanging on this wall, where you started with this archives, but then also used AI. So could you tell us a bit about this?
So this was
perhaps we even go there to bringing a
there?
Bit
Let's
to
go.
Bringing a bit movement
or
in the.
I could use some movement.
So then also everyone has it in front of their eyes.
Thank you. This was beautiful.
No, it's super interesting. Thank you. So, yeah. So, perhaps everyone can have a quick look, and then,
yeah.
Or if you want, don't be shy.
So this was kind of like a capsule project that just contains 12 images. Or 11 images, I think. This was a project that I showed last year at Paris Plus. Basically, what the once Treat Me Like Your Mother was kind of out in the world, so the trans archive was out in the world. Once it was no longer something that was just for me and that I was just seeing myself, etc. Once it was something that people were having conversations about, I started realizing actually how small the archive really was. I mean, for us the work was just ginormous. It was so much, like we were so happy because we had nothing. So in comparison, it was just a lot of images and a lot of stories. But in reality, an archive of 300 images is a very small archive. And there are so many reasons behind the fact that we were only able in 5 years to collect so many images. One of the reasons was the fact that a lot of these women came from backgrounds that were financially would not necessarily allow for these women to be able to have cameras or films and be able to develop them back in the 70s and the 80s, etc. Other reasons were the fact that whatever color positives or negatives did exist were destroyed during the Civil War. So the scarcity of these images was something that, of these archives, was just a big topic of conversation around the project. And at the same time, AI, artificial intelligence, was becoming something that was very accessible to all of us. You know, we can just like sign up to Midjourney or whatever, and you can just use artificial intelligence to create images. And you know, there was this whole uproar about how, you know, AI is the devil and we're all gonna die. And you know, And so this project, which is called Extended Archives, which is kind of like almost like an experiment or questions. It offers more questions than it offers answers. Was basically what is and what will be, but already what is the effect of artificial intelligence on the archiving practice specifically? Because so far, an archivist would be able to look at a color positive or an image that dates from the 80s and you know, their lives would continue. Yes, that is an image from the 80s. That is no longer the case because a new hurdle has been created for any archivist, which is whenever they see an image, they have to make sure it is a real image and not a generated image, which is something that hasn't, protocols have not yet been put in place to be able to really recognize these things, especially when we think about the metadata, like any generated image on an artificial intelligence software has a virgin metadata, so it could literally be a scan. So there's no tracking the fact that it's an image that's generated with artificial intelligence. Questions, so many questions, so many like problematics that are around artificial intelligence, and they're always very, they fall in the negative sphere, right? How is artificial intelligence just terrible and bad and all these problems that it's creating? And yes, those are very valid, and protocols need to be put in place, such as, I think, Getty Images right now, or Shutterstock, I think, has already started putting in protocols where one must tag an image as a generated image and things like that, but these are still very user-based. They're still not protocols that are really in place. So the, also, so I wanted to add more questions to these questions about artificial intelligence when it comes to the archiving process, but more veering them towards the positive as well, because as much as we can talk about the negatives, there are also some positives. And so one of the main questions was, how can we use artificial intelligence to actually bridge a visual gap in an archive for a minority or a marginalized community that doesn't necessarily or wasn't able to really preserve their archives basically. So what I did was take from the oral histories of the women, take certain events from the oral histories of the women, or in some points talk about a take from certain images that they would tell us about but they wouldn't be able to find so that they can show us. And we utilized three other image sources, their own archives, so the archives from Treat Me Like Your Mother that we were able to collect, additional archives from the Arab Image Foundation that would provide some visual context to a specific time or area or something, and my own personal past work, so portraits I've done for like fashion magazines and things like that. And using those three image sources, and adding to that just the actual oral histories, we created prompts that were basically able to create these extra archives as if they were real archives from some of the stories that they told us. And that's why it's called extended archives, fake archives that are based off of Treat Me Like Your Mother and the women's stories. So here, for example, I walked in. Okay, here, for example, this is Antonella's bedroom. And so this is from a story that Antonella was telling us about this. So there's this one night where Antonella used to work at a club where she danced at this club. And at one night, her brother walks into the club with a machine gun and just opens fire on the entire club. And then she didn't go home that night. She slept somewhere else. And why are you smiling? But why do you have the lights on like that? To see this?
Yeah.
I think everyone's already seen it when there was light. Yeah. It's fine.
Okay.
I think we're good.
We have also seen you now.
No one needs to see me. So she didn't sleep at home that night, and then the next morning when she went to her apartment, she realized that her apartment had been completely ransacked. Her brother had walked into her apartment, destroyed everything. And the peculiar thing about her story was that she focused on one specific thing, which is And I quote Khazza' li posterat Madonna, which is, he tore down all of my Lady Madonna posters. And this was, like, he destroyed everything. Like, he destroyed her appliances, everything. But that's what angered her the most. The fact that he tore down her Madonna pictures. And it's not Madonna that you know, because at the same time that Madonna, like, we call her the Western Madonna, which is Madonna that I'm guessing you know, is at the same time we had a Madonna come out of Lebanon. She was like this extravagant pop star that like would rival Lady Gaga today, like insane. Like her clothes during the 80s were insane. And she was like a big gay pop icon, like a queer pop icon. So yeah, I had a point. She was very mad about that, yes, thank you. She was very mad about that. Anyway, so from that story, we pieced together Antonella's bedroom along with the posters of Lady Madonna, and then the rest being ransacked. So that's one of them. And this one is based off of several pictures from several, we say balls, even though balls wasn't really a term that was used, because balls is a term that comes from the Harlem ballroom scene, but there was really no term for those parties. They called them bal masqué, so masquerades, because French colonialism. But yeah, so this was based off of many, many archival images from balls, and the if you come closer, but not now, I will feel claustrophobic. the dresses and what they're wearing was actually described by one of the women in the book, Am Abed, where she was describing one of the nights, and for some reason she was throwing shade at what some of the women were wearing, some of her friends were wearing that night, and so we tried to recreate the exact dresses the way she described them, and yeah, so there's that. And I will now step back and sit down.
So I would say perhaps we skip the open question and keep this to the informal, or is, I don't know, what is the, how do you feel?
Indifference.
Indifference. Or is there a pressing question you want to ask?
Open question.
Hmm?
Open question.
Yeah, a pressing question, yeah. Do you have one or?
No.
Okay. So it seems that we already switched to the informal part. I think that's totally fine. But I want to thank again Mohammed for this very insightful conversation. It was super interesting. And also thanks a lot for your interest and for the organization. Thank you so much.
You are still alive.